You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Farad. Coming up, we'll meet a UW doctor who helps make sure that TV shows and movies get all those medical details just right.
First, members of the Wisconsin Ethics Commission and the Wisconsin Elections Commission made their response to a report by Attorney General Brad Schimmel yesterday. In the report, Schimmel examined how documents about the secret John Doe investigation were leaked to the press.
The Ethics Commission is asking Schimmel to correct what they say are inaccuracies in that report. The Elections Commission is standing by its staff who were criticized in the report.
Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So let's take a second. What did Attorney General Brad Schimmel say in his report last week?
So the report came out last Wednesday, and basically if you're going to boil down what Schimmel said in the report, it was that people who worked at the now-defunct Government Accountability Board handled the John Doe evidence pretty poorly. They didn't secure it very well. In his report, he said exactly, he called it systemic and pervasive mishandling of that John Doe evidence. So he's implying basically because the GAB mishandled this evidence, it led to the leak to the Guardian newspaper, which published that story with hundreds of documents. I think it was 1,500 pages of John Doe documents in September of 2016.
And what was that original John Doe investigation, just as a refresher, looking into?
The John Doe investigation was looking into possible illegal coordination between Governor Scott Walker's political campaign and conservative groups, and kind of third-party outside groups.
And bringing us back up to now, the report that Schimmel released last week, what were the conclusions in that report?
Well, what Schimmel wanted at the tail end of the report, which was a rather lengthy report, he was calling for disciplinary actions for several people, nine individuals total. And where this gets kind of sticky and more interesting, and where the Elections and Ethics Commissions really come into this, is that one of those nine individuals is a current staff member for the Elections Commission. So he was a lawyer for the Government Accountability Board, and now he's a lawyer for the Elections Commission. His name is Nate Judnick.
And what exactly are, you know, the issues that Schimmel took with Judnick in particular?
So essentially, I mean, the report really focused on obviously how the GAB was handling these documents, how they were securing them, whether they were cooperating fully and handing things over as they knew them, things like that. So Judnick, being the legal counsel for the GAB, Schimmel is saying that his involvement in it makes him unqualified to be a part of. Well, actually, Schimmel isn't talking about being unqualified for the Elections Commission. Other people have said that. Schimmel's just saying he mishandled things and he should be reprimanded and be found in contempt of court. So.
And, I mean, that seems like a pretty a hefty charge to make, that he would be in contempt of court. Now, looking at the report, not necessarily from Schimmel's perspective, but maybe looking at the Ethics Commission, what is the Ethics Commission disputing exactly here?
So the Ethics Commission, rather, was really unhappy with this report. They put out a letter yesterday detailing some of their concerns. I think the two big things that the Ethics Commission was concerned with were, one, they wanted Schimmel to acknowledge that the Ethics Commission cooperated fully with the John Doe investigation, you know, were helpful, et cetera, willing participants. And secondly, that the Ethics Commission security, that the security they have in place is better than the Government Accountability Board security that existed when the John Doe investigation was going on. So those were kind of the two biggies. There were a number of other concerns, though. They said, you know, we were called out for not reporting a crime, but we couldn't have reported a crime, you know, with these leaks because no commissioner, no staff member of the Ethics Commission had ever been read into the John Doe secrecy order. There wasn't anybody in our agency who had knowledge of the content of the leaked documents before they were published, and so none of us were able to identify that an illegal leak had occurred. So that's another part. There was another part about the Fifth Amendment right to counsel, some claims that Schimmel made in the report that they said just aren't true in terms of Ethics Commission members invoking the Fifth Amendment, their right to counsel. They said that it was members of the Ethics Commission, not those individuals. Then there was another thing about this folder. Some people may have heard about the opposition research folder that was outlined in Schimmel's report. And the Ethics Commission said, hey, it's our understanding that, you know, this file, this opposition research file, was one of the pieces of evidence seized during the John Doe investigation, and it wasn't a document prepared inside of the Government Accountability Board.
Lot to get to there. We're talking to Laurel White. She is the state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin Public Radio News, and she's with us to talk about this report that came down from State Attorney General Brad Schimmel, looking into the leak of some 1,500 documents in a John Doe investigation. So, what do leaders want Schimmel to do here? What are they calling on him to take care of?
Well, the Ethics Commission is calling for Schimmel to issue a clarification on his report to kind of address some of those concerns I just long-windedly summarized.
No, we needed the information, Laurel.
It's complicated. But so they want him to say our security policies are better than they were at the GAB, and we've fully cooperated. So they issued that request in their letter yesterday, and Schimmel actually responded yesterday and said, hey, your concerns aren't valid, basically, and that he has no plans to issue those statements clarifying his report.
Now, the Elections Commission actually had a closed-door meeting yesterday. Do we know anything about what happened in that meeting?
Well, we don't, because, you know, the nature of a closed-door meeting. But they did come out, and we know what their statements were after they came out of the meeting, so we can kind of infer what they discussed. They said that nothing in the DOJ report, Attorney General Brad Schimmel's report, has caused them to question their leader, Mike Haas. He's the administrator of the Elections Commission. And essentially, you know, they support him. They support Nate Judnick. That's the lawyer I mentioned who worked for the GAB and now works for them. And they also said that they plan to ask Governor Scott Walker to appoint a lawyer for them to help with any matters that might arise for them in the wake of this DOJ report.
Now, the Elections Commission and the Ethics Commission were spun out of the now defunct GAB, and it looks like there's been some speculation that it is less, free of sort of the government itself. Are any of the employees worried about how this investigation could have repercussions for them moving forward in these commissions?
Well, that was a big thing that was discussed yesterday after the Elections Commission members made the statement about having faith in Mike Haas and Nate Judnick, who worked for the GAB and now work for them. They said, you know, and this is Mark Thompson, I guess, if I'm going to quote someone specifically who was speaking for the Elections Commission, he said, we have complete faith in Mike Haas. We have complete faith in Nate Judnick. They've always done a good job here. We feel like they're working in the interest of Wisconsin voters. And our job is to make sure elections in Wisconsin Elections Commission, are safe and secure. And we really want to get back to doing that and not focusing on whether people should leave the commissions because of an affiliation they had with the GAB.
Laurel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She joined us with the latest news on the state attorney general's report on leaks in a John Doe probe. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Conservationist Aldo Leopold gave a series of talks in the 1930s on WHA. Unfortunately, we don't have the recordings, but we do have the transcripts. UW Professor Emeritus Stan Temple shares one of Leopold's talks from December 1933 on the importance of winter bird feeding.
One of the pleasures which is denied the landless multitude of the cities, but which is accessible to every farmer, is the opportunity to see and live with wild birds. Winter is the time to see birds at close range. The whole bird world, if you want it to be, will perform for you daily under your very windowsill. The price of the show is a little forethought and a few handfuls of food. It is necessary, of course, to keep the yard free of cats. Too many dogs or squirrels are likewise undesirable. The Winter Bird Show has a deeper meaning than mere entertainment. Winter feeding is the most effective kind of conservation. One feeding station is worth a dozen sermons on the love of nature. As in other conservation work, skill, intelligence, and sustained effort are needed. There's no better way to teach a boy or girl the futility of good resolutions unbacked by persistence and brain work. Try it for the sake of the birds, the boy, and the better farm life. When Aldo Leopold was doing his pioneering studies of the factors that were controlling the abundance of wildlife populations, food, especially food during the winter, became an obvious bottleneck for most populations. And in these talks, Aldo Leopold encourages farmers and other landowners to feed birds during the winter. Winter bird feeding was not as popular back in the 1920s and 1930s as it is now. It has become a very popular activity, not only in rural but also in urban areas. Surveys have shown that perhaps 2/3 to 3/4 of American households feed birds during the winter. So it's a major conservation exercise. As Aldo Leopold correctly identified, it may be the most common form of wildlife management in the U.S., in that more people are involved, clearly more money is spent on bird seed and bird feeders and bird guides and binoculars and other paraphernalia. Than all other conservation activities probably combined.
Stan Temple held the same position as Leopold at the UW. Now retired, he's a senior fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, if you watch any TV shows or movies that have a dramatic hospital scene, you see a lot of details at play. Everything from what treatments are given to equipment to how actors portray suffering from an illness or injury.
But do filmmakers get those details right? Our next guest is there to help out. Dr. Jonathan Kohler is a pediatric surgeon at UW Health. He also consults on TV shows and movies to make sure that it's medically accurate. Dr. Kohler, welcome to Central Time.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, when you were watching TV and movies as a doctor, what kind of things were you seeing when it came to how your profession was portrayed?
Well, you know, I trained in Seattle at the University of Washington, which is ostensibly the Grey's Anatomy program. And I remember looking around, that was sort of right around the time that Grey's Anatomy was, you know, the number one TV show, and looking around and saying that this is not my life. You know, they're outside the hospital in daylight, and there's a lot more canoodling going on than I was seeing in our hospital. But more importantly, you know, that I felt like TV could be doing a better job to show people what it meant to go to the hospital.
So what kind of things did you see them getting wrong when it came to that, the medical stuff and the procedural stuff?
Yeah, so my far and away least favorite thing to see is, and you see it all the time if you start looking on television, is, you know, a young, pretty actor has a cardiac arrest, and about 20 minutes later, they're sitting up in bed with a little, what we call nasal cannula. It's a little, like, oxygen tube that goes in the nose, and they're talking, and they're cheery, and they're happy, and I think that that sort of thing sets really bad expectations for patients about what happens if, you know, someone in their own family is critically ill and goes to the hospital, and then they go in and they see, oh, they're on a ventilator, they're kind of puffy, they have IV bags surrounding them, they're not able to communicate, and I think that sort of expectation is where television can be really helpful, and where it can also be potentially harmful. Just making sure that people have valid expectations about what it's going to look like if they themselves have to go to the hospital.
So, how did you get involved in working on TV shows and movies?
Well, I started, I had from a very early age, I was fascinated by theater. I did a lot of theater growing up. And then when I got to medical school, it became increasingly clear that it was going to be hard to do things that depended on being in the same place every night for a set period of time. So I started experimenting more with film and really found it to be really satisfying to produce on my own. But then, obviously, you know, in medicine, it's hard to even find time to do that sort of thing. So I got really interested in just being part of the storytelling and the way that, that films get made. And I got a master's degree in health communication while I was doing some research work in Boston. And through that program, got put in touch with a group at the University of Southern California that was doing consults for film and TV writers. And then that was sort of one-off questions, you know, how many lungs does a person have type thing. So it was sort of a human Google search. But then through that, ended up becoming connected with a writer who was developing a pilot. And, you know, at that point it was a one-sentence pitch, and we built it out into a script that then got shot in Toronto. And it ended up not getting filmed, but that writer became my son's godfather, and I met 200 people who dispersed to other shows. And then I was sort of in... I was on a list.
And so when you are brought in, could you come in at any stage from pilot to, or writing that initial script to actually you're on set as they're filming?
Yeah, I do everything. So a lot of what I do is via email, helping a lot around pilot season, and then a lot with sort of individual episodes. So, you know, a show that is not necessarily a medical show has a medical plot line, and they just need to sort of some help getting it realistic. We do that, and it's usually you can do it with a phone call and some emails back and forth. And then if, you know, we're shooting a full-on medical scene, oftentimes I'll go to the set and be on set and sort of make sure that all the visual details are correct, and then I can help the actors understand how to portray illness and how to portray being a doctor.
Is there ever a battle between, you know, the desire to make this dramatic or make sure we have a good line of sight to our attractive acting person versus the medical reality?
All the time. And I think that one of the things that we do particularly well is that I think, you know, I came up in narrative. I came up in drama and in film, and have always really appreciated that. And so I understand what writers want to do. And I understand the constraints that they're facing. And so, you know, if they come back to me and say, like, there's just no way that we can portray this disease taking 3 weeks, like it has to happen over 3 days, like usually we can figure out a way to make that realistic. So if they come to me and say, you know, I say, like, maybe we just need a different disease, something that accomplishes what you want to do, but it happens over 3 days instead of 3 weeks. And we find compromises that way. But, you know, there are definitely times when I'll sort of draw a line and say, look, this what you want to do is just not realistic. And in my experience, you know, if someone's gone through the trouble of hiring you to come there and tell them what it is and is not realistic, then they listen and you just come up with something better.
Is there a scene that you've been involved in that you feel particularly proud of, that this really told the story in a good way and told people what the reality was like in a medical setting?
Well, I mean, there's a bunch of pilots that I've done that I feel like it's just tragic that they never made it to air because they were so cool. Recently I did this movie with up in Toronto called A Family Man, and I was really proud of that film. I got involved sort of in the late script stage when they were trying to think of a way to have they basically came and said they have a kid that they need to have some sort of cancer and needs to progress, and then they need sort of a revolutionary therapy for it, and then that therapy needs to fail, and there needs to be a really tense moment trying to figure out, well, is this kid going to live or die, and then ideally we want to get him out of it at the end. And there was a new therapy kind of just reported at that time called CAR T-cell therapy, which is basically where you take T-cells, immune cells from a patient, take them out of the patient, transform them to attack a cancer, and then re-inject them back in. And at that point, it was, you know, two case reports. And we wrote the script around that. I helped the writer, Bill Dubuque, do that. And then we told the story of this kid getting this revolutionary therapy. And around the time that the film actually came out earlier this summer, that therapy got approved and is now looking like it's going to be an incredible therapy for leukemia and lymphoma, which is really cool to sort of have anticipated
Wow.
a big new development in cancer therapy, and it was really satisfying to be on set for that. I was there for 2 weeks, you know, just standing next to the director, this guy Mark Williams, for 2 weeks, just sort of tweaking every medical scene. And we tried to tell a bunch of medical stories for the medical people. So if you look at the monitors in that movie, you'll see that we're really telling a story with the vital signs of the patient. We can sort of give you a hint that trouble's coming. And then we also have all these IV poles and IV pumps around him. And you can see as he gets sicker, there's more and more. And then as he gets better, fewer and fewer of them around him. And it's fun to sort of tell little stories on the inside of the story with tricks like that.
As we wrap up, Dr. Kohler, I'm tempted to ask about, you know, something that gets it really wrong so I can snark about it, but I'll go the other way. Is there a show or movie that you weren't involved in that you watch and say, yeah, they really do a good job?
You know, I think that season one of Scrubs, the Christmas episode, gets medicine as right as anything I've ever seen. And I think that show is hugely influential among doctors. I think we all recognize that it captures, with comedy and with sort of outlandish situations, the reality of what it means to be a doctor better than most any other show I've ever seen. I mean, the other one I think is MASH. You know, I mean, like, that's an untouchable legend in medical TV that I think we'll never see anything that good again.
Dr. Kohler, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Real pleasure.
Dr. Jonathan Kohler is a pediatric surgeon at UW Health. He also consults on TV shows and movies to make sure they get all the medical details right. Now, an officer was acquitted in a Mesa, Arizona shooting death last week. But after the trial, the police department released a body cam video of the shooting. This week, it's getting an angry response around the nation.
Here's what happened back in 2016. Daniel Shaver, who worked in pest control, showed his pellet gun to another person at a hotel room in Mesa. Someone saw the gun through a window and reported it to police. Officers then responded.
On the video, Officer Philip Brailsford's AR-15 rifle is trained on Daniel Shaver in the hotel hallway, while another officer gives instructions to Shaver and a woman. Ultimately, Brailsford fires multiple shots, killing Shaver.
Officer Brailsford was acquitted on charges of murder and manslaughter. His lawyer argued that Shaver had bent his arm in a way consistent with reaching for a firearm and that Officer Brailsford followed his training. Others who watched the video say Shaver was most likely trying to pull up his shorts, which had fallen while he was crawling in compliance with police orders.
The video is reviving the debate over the use of force by police and over police tactics. Reverend David Cooper joins us now. He's the former Madison police chief and author of Arrested Development, a veteran police chief sounds off about protest, racism, corruption, and the 7 necessary steps to improve our nation's police. David, welcome back to the show.
Nice to be here today.
Well, David, I want to start by listening to some of this police video. Listeners, this may be disturbing. We do stop the audio here before the shots are fired. Here's a listen.
Okay, young man, listen to my instructions and do not make a mistake. You are to keep your legs crossed. Do you understand me?
Yes, sir.
You are to put both of your hands, palms down, straight out in front of you. Push yourself up to a kneeling position. I said, keep your legs crossed!
I'm sorry.
I didn't say this in conversation.
Put your hand!
Hands up in the air! You do that again, we're shooting you. Do you understand?
Please do not shoot me.
Listen to my instructions.
I'm trying to do what you...
Don't talk! Listen! Hands straight up in the air. Do not put your hands down for any reason. You think you're going to fall, you better fall on your face. Your hands go back in the small of your back or down. We are going to shoot you. Do you understand me?
Yes, sir.
Crawl towards me. Crawl towards me!
David Cooper, what do you hear in the officer's instructions there and in the way Daniel Shaver complied with them in the video?
Yeah, it's terrible. I've seen this video, by the way, probably 5 or 6 times, looked over it again. It's just really bad police work. And it shows the problem we have today, and I think the problem citizens have in looking at something like this and saying, you know, that's just out of bounds. I wouldn't want a loved one like mine treated like this. And then we revert back to an old, fairly old now, U.S. Supreme Court decision, Graham v. Connor, I think it was back in 1989, which sort of is the low bar standard that says that what are circumstances we want to put cops in prison, and the standard is pretty low. It said if an officer reasonably believes, objectively believes that he or she is fear of his or her life, then force can be used in this situation. This clearly, I don't know where this officer got trained. He's he's probably emotionally roaring forward. He is taking basic felony stop training and kind of turned it around. You don't make people crawl on their hands and knees to you. You don't threaten people. If he was to do this, the proper way would be to have the suspect get down on his knees, face the other way, away from the officer, cross your legs, put your hands on top of your head, and then another officer comes over and quickly handcuffs the person, restrains them. So this is somehow, you hear the accelerating emotion of his voice there, and it is like a lot of these shootings that I've reviewed, mainly because I'm teaching criminal justice at UW-Platteville. I've got a couple of classes down there, and we do go through these. And the problem here is that the officer is not able to self-manage his emotions, and I think that's what we're going through. Had this occurred in a town where there's a significant people of color and the person was of color, we would have major disturbances today. And maybe we could look at this one. Here's one white guy shooting another white guy and saying, this too is bad, and this too should not happen.
And that is civil rights groups, including some prominent members of Black Lives Matter, have responded to this event, even though, as you say, Daniel Shaver himself is white. So you've written about issues of race, but you say there's a fundamental issue, too, of police procedure, how police are trained and behave in a situation like this.
Sure. Well, since Ferguson, we've had increasing talk about de-escalation. That isn't new in police lingo. Certainly, back in my day, it was conflict management and understanding that people who are intoxicated, people who are mentally ill, people who are going through an emotional crisis, don't respond very well to people like screaming at them and gets them more confused. This situation could have been managed much better. The officer could have taken cover, backed off here. I see they got the woman off the scene very, very, very quickly and just managed the situation by just saying, okay, buddy, let's just slow down here. This is what I want you to do. I want you to turn around, get down on your knees, cross your legs, interlock your hands on top of your head, hold it now, we're going to manage this thing, just be calm. But what we're seeing here is that the officer, and I don't know how long he's been on the police department, I don't know what kind of training he's gone through, but the key to this job over and over again, and what makes good cops is they manage their emotions in fearful situations. That's what makes them different. That's why we respect police because we expect them to be able to be controlled when everybody else is going nuts.
Talking to David Cooper, former Madison police chief, about police procedure and a shooting of a video of a police shooting that was released over the last week. David Cooper, as I think about it, I mean, it would be easy for me to say an officer should remain calm, but in the report here, they know there's a gun present somewhere in this situation. They've heard stories, I'm sure, of police in situations where very quickly someone reached for a firearm, and in some cases police have died in this situation. I mean, is it appropriate for us to judge the officer, the colleague of Officer Brailsford here who was shouting, or Officer Brailsford himself, in this tense situation where they know there might be a gun present?
Well, I can. I worked in this business for over 30 years. I used to train cops in defensive tactics. I've been in these critical situations before, and I know they work when we remain calm. And maybe we have to back off a little bit, taking cover here. And as I understand, the call here was somebody thought the person had a firearm in a hotel window, and this person I checked into it was a animal exterminator, and he did have a pellet gun. But even if there was a real live firearm present here, this isn't the best way to handle this situation. I mean, I'm sure, I would hope, and I think I would be comfortable, though cops are very, very hesitant to criticize other cops. But if we had, you know, 10 senior police officers here, you know, and certainly I'd be comfortable if it was the Madison Police Department and said, look at the scene, would you have done that? And all 10 said, no. Now, what they will say is that I wouldn't have done it that way, but it's difficult for me to judge what another officer did in this situation. And that's true, and that's fair. But the fact is, when police officers see these situations, they can say, no, I wouldn't do it that way.
You've talked about police attitudes and sort of a military mindset creeping into policing in some cases. In this case, the officer Brailsford, had this AR-15 rifle. It was etched with the words, "You're effed." I'm cleaning up the language. The judge didn't allow that fact to be presented to the jury. Do you think that points in any way toward a mentality of an aggressive mentality, I guess?
Well, that's right. And what you need to have, if you're going to be an effective street cop, you've got to have a number of tools in your kit. And what we're seeing here is I think just maybe it's lack of training, not thinking through this, but you know, using sort of the tactical voice, and then getting the tactical procedure screwed up, was a major error here, and there are times, and especially in dealing with people who are mentally ill, and understanding that people who are suffering from schizophrenia are really, really slow to respond to commands, may not even hear your commands, may not even process that. So you've got to do other ways. Maybe you start the tactical approach. Stop, get down, don't move right now. All right, now, hey, now tell me what's going on. I don't want you to move, but this is what I want you to do. You hear me? And nobody will get hurt. So to be able to regulate, to self-regulate. Everything doesn't have to be up there, you know, 100%. You know, this is, you know, we're not every day in Mortal Kombat. You know, most police officers, you know, never fire their weapon in the course of a 30-year career. So most police officers who are effective in this job, who are good cops, have a variety of approaches and techniques, are self-regulating, can understand what's going on, have some kind of background in understanding people, so they don't get caught up, so that they are out of control.
We're talking about police tactics and the use of force by police. After the release of body cam video footage showing a police shooting in Mesa, Arizona, Reverend David Cooper is with us. He's a former chief of the Madison Police Department.
And you can join the conversation now by calling 800-642-1234. Have you watched this video? What was your reaction? Do you think police are too quick to use deadly force, or do you think that they're justified given the risks that they face? And if you have worked in law enforcement, what's your perspective on these issues? You can call in right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're talking to former Madison Police Chief David Cooper right now. We're looking at police tactics and the use of force after the release of a controversial body cam video in Arizona.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you watched this video? What is your reaction to it? And on the wider issues, what do you think of the way police are trained, the way they deal with difficult situations and their difficult job, and the use of force? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Right to your calls now. Muhammad is with us in Madison. Muhammad, hi.
Hi there. I've not seen the video, but just from listening to that, the voice of reason seemed to be on the side of the person that they were called about. But I was telling your screener that I lived in Mesa, Arizona for 2 years. I moved there from Madison in 2014 and moved back here in 2015. And the thing that I was most terrified there while I was there for that period of time was being pulled over by the police. I mean, I saw them, they killed this African-American woman who left a mental health facility and she threatened someone there, went to her home, six officers, the sergeant is in front, she opens the door, she's got a hammer in her hand, he shot her six times, a middle-aged woman that was known to have a mental health problem. It scared me. Well, I was terrified.
Mohammed, thank you for calling and sharing your story. David, is this a case where, I don't know the history of the Mesa Department, but is it maybe something that could be endemic to a particular police department and how they're trained?
Well, I don't know what's going on in Mesa, but we see time and time again in these videos, and I bet I've seen over 100 of them since Ferguson. What do we see in what the caller talked about is a situation, a woman appearing at the door with a hammer and immediately being shot. We saw a video of that just a few months ago involving two Dallas police officers. The 911 call was a woman called the dispatch and said, you know, my son is mentally ill. He's having some problems now. Would you please send some trained officers? And two officers showed up. She walks out the door saying, I just can't control him anymore. He appears at the door with a screwdriver in his hand, and within 4 or 5 seconds, he's shot multiple times and dies. Both these situations that the caller mentioned is to me situations that we back off right away. I mean, we back off. We get some distance here. Hey, put the hammer down. Let's talk. That's the way good cops handle these things without shooting people every time they go to a call like this. And sometimes, you know, backing up, lowering your voice works. And I know that, you know, these are situations where the person didn't appear with a handgun, so you've got to make an immediate decision about what to do. A person, you know, 4 or 5 feet away from you, holding a handgun. These are not firearms. These are, you know, blunt weapons, sharp weapons, screwdrivers, hammers, those kind of things. But even in the training, you know, the training started out when back in my era when we had six shots in a revolver, shoot once. And then the training ramped up, and we were told, shoot twice at targets. Now, I think with our, you know, high volume semi-automatic pistols right now, it's to shoot until you don't have any more bullets. So back in the past, officers had to be very careful because we didn't carry a lot of ammunition, and it was very, very difficult in a stress situation to reload a six shooter. Excuse me. So we had to be very, very careful. Now I think the technology has contributed to a lot of this, and now the training's got to catch up.
Mohammed, thanks for that call. We're talking to David Cooper, former Madison police chief, about police-involved shootings. We'll go next to Amy on the line in Lake Geneva. Amy, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call in and say that I'm very impressed by your guest, and he just seems very level-headed and very wise. And I think part of that comes with age, but part of that is, you know, judgment of the person. And I think, you know, I think police officers need to, the training, I agree, needs to change. And I also think, and I've always wondered, why do police officers have to shoot to kill? Why can't they shoot to disable the person? You know, because we're killing all of these people who are, you know, someone's child or loved one. And I myself have a very close relative who has bipolar, and she actually had an incident with an officer, and it resolved itself very well. I mean, she actually, I believe, attempted to hit the officer or kick the officer, and in some cases I'm sure the officer probably could have shot her and very likely gotten away with it, but he knew how to handle it because he was trained. And I had been asked at one point to even be on a panel to help educate, you know, police officers about mental illness and to have them see, you know, the family members of those people.
Amy, I want to jump in because we don't have too much time left, and there's a lot there. David, for that last point first, officers trained to deal with mental illness. I mean, there's a lot that goes into being a police officer, and it's extra special training in some ways to deal with people dealing with mental illness issues.
Sure. The training is really important, and some departments across the country have had special units of officers specially trained. You're like Memphis and that to have special training to go to these situations where people are mentally ill. But the fact is the nature of urban policing today is every officer has to be a mental health specialist because we're coming into contact more and more, and this has gone on since the late 70s when we had the deinstitutionalization. We've got a lot of people around who are suffering from mental illness and who are operating very well, but once in a while they have meltdowns. And police just need to have those skills. And that was a very important skill for police to have because they are mental health workers, social workers who happen to have weapons that they can use force to protect people.
Amy, thanks for that call. David, as we start to wrap up, you mentioned the idea of officers being needing training and being self-regulated, controlling their emotions. I mean, this, among the reasons I would be a bad cop, this is a conflict-oriented job. Nobody calls you to say, things are fine, come on by. It's all conflict. How do you train someone to keep their emotions in control when they go from one situation of conflict to another?
Well, it's training, and it's also taking care of our police officers. I mean, this is where the president's task force talked about, and the police executive research forum talked about, this use of force stuff. The research forum said, the sanctity of human life should be the core of all that police do, and President Obama's task force on 21st century policing talked about. One of the pillars, the six pillars, is health and wellness of our officers. More officers are dying by suicide each year than are being killed in the line of duty by bad guys. So what we have to do is make sure that we're taking care of the men and women who are serving us. We must see that they're adequately compensated, they have adequate time off, and that we have systems in place so that they can develop and keep healthy lifestyles. Because they have to have their stuff together to be able to do the tasks that we're asking them to do today.
We'll leave it there, David. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Anytime. Peace. Bye-bye.
That's Reverend David Cooper. He's a former Madison police chief and author of the book Arrested Development. A veteran police chief sounds off about protest, racism, corruption, and the seven necessary steps to improve our nation's police.